The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome. I'm Grant. I am Dr. Horner, but I just prefer to be called Grant. I've been working on my wife for years, after 35 years, to just stick with, like, your worshipful majesty or your gloriousness, but that doesn't work. Everybody just calls me Horner. I actually respond to that. My students call me Horner. Hey, Horner, who wrote Plato's Metamorphoses? The students, of course, they don't graduate. My wife calls me Horner. Oh, yes, I know that you speak all these languages, but go take out the trash, Horner, because the trash is full, that kind of stuff. I'm a professor of Renaissance and Reformation studies at the Master's University in Los Angeles. That was my boss and friend, Dr. MacArthur, who knocked it out of the park, I thought, the other day, talking about the absolute centrality of Scripture to the classical education movement and everything else. I'm also the founder and director of the Master's University in Italy program and the designer and director of the new Christian Liberal Arts major at Master's University, where we will be training the next generation of people to teach in all of your schools. So send us your best. Not the ones who are like, oh, I'm not good enough at math to be an engineer, so I'll just be a teacher. No, send us your best students. Let us train them and mentor them and bring them up and send them back to your school or other schools so they can keep doing all the wonderful stuff that you guys are doing so fabulously. Because all of us, for the most part, had to be retrofitted, right? I didn't get a classical education until I was halfway through a PhD and said, wait, there's all this old cool stuff I've never read before. Right, and we know what it's like. We have to be retrained and retrofitted and completely, you know, re-undiscombobulated in order to learn how to provide the kind of education that none of us really got. Right, and so I'll be talking about that a little bit tomorrow morning with plenary. I'm also, ironically enough, a visiting professor of doctoral level Latin at Fuller Seminary in Pasadena, right down the road from where I live on the north side of Los Angeles, which means I'm a conservative evangelical reform guy who teaches the language of the Catholics to the liberal Protestants. Every now and then I slip in the gospel, you know, just because, you know, you never know. I spend a lot of my research time working in the manuscript and early printed materials department at the Huntington Library, which is the greatest collection of medieval and Renaissance manuscripts probably outside of Oxford and the Vatican Library, and it's right there in beautiful Pasadena. It's a wonderful. I was showing some of my friends in the Alcuin Fellowship. We stay up late at night and talk about all things classical and so on and so forth. I was showing them some photographs on my iPad of some manuscripts I've worked on recently, some of the love letters between John Donne and Anne Moore, and the beg letters that he wrote to Thomas Edgerton. Please don't fire me because, you know, I ran off with your best friend's, you know, like 16-year-old niece and all this kind of stuff. So it's, you know, people are people, no matter what age they live in, right? Almost a dozen years ago, I was became the founding chair of humanities at Trinity Classical Academy in the north part of Los Angeles County, right down the road from my house. And that's been a real blessing. Probably, at least for the first 10 years, it was the fastest growing classical school in America. Went from zero to nearly 600 in about 8 or 9 years. Just a wonderful experience that's been. I'm also IMC, which is Insane Mountain Climber. In the last couple of days before I came here, I climbed 2 14,000-foot-plus mountains with you know, technical ice climbing and rock climbing training, a couple of young alpinists. So if I limp, it's not because I'm old, it's just because I'm old enough that it really, really hurts to go up and down these things. And being at low altitude in a place like Texas, the air is all warm and thick, so if I could breathe like every 20 minutes, I'm happy. You know, I'm not going on a quarter of the oxygen that you do there. So what this is not really a talk. I can sling a lecture, but I'd rather not. This is going to be a demonstration of Socratics. And I do these from time to time at SCL and ACCS and Alcuin Fellows retreats and different schools that I visit all over the country. And what we're going to do is we're just going to watch and participate and analyze in a Socratic discussion on something that the people that I'm about to volunteer in a few moments probably don't know anything about. Okay? And so we're going to talk through how this works and what works and what doesn't work. And what's interesting is when you do a Socratic discussion, and those of you that try to teach with Socratic pedagogy, you're aware that sometimes it's just the most exciting thing in the world, and it's brilliant and scintillating, and your students are, the light bulbs are going off. It's like Westinghouse is in their head, and it's just so beautiful and fabulous. And other times it's a dumpster fire behind a place that slaughters kittens, okay? I mean, this is not working. I should have worked harder in math class and been an engineer and this and that and the other thing. And that's really what it's like. A few of you may have read, and I would recommend if this kind of thing interests you, or you want to learn how to do this, or how to do it better, or how to kind of theorize and theologize about it, I published an article a few years ago in SCL. It's in one of the online journals now, called The Socratic Method is Utterly Pagan, and It's a Good Thing, Too. Right? Because here's the question, right? Why should Christians use a pagan method for at least some of their pedagogical practice? Why would you use the method, these kind of Platonic, Socratic method that is developed by these people are pagans? And I explained in there why, even though they're pagans, there is a certain kind of validity, and it's a theological validity, not what they believe, but what they believed and suppressed about human knowledge and wisdom and virtue and understanding, and always comes back out when you try to think things through. It's really right out of Paul's anthropology in Romans 1, 18 through 22 or so. And what is very important when you think about classical education, you think about anything, is the ability to make distinctions. You have to learn to make distinctions. It's absolutely central to any kind of clarity of thought. Don't believe me? Read the news, right? In my state, California, right, they are teaching gender dysphoria to kindergartners. Oh, you know, you might be a boy on Monday, a girl on Tuesday. You won't even know what you are by Thursday, right? If you can't tell what you are, that speaks to your inability to think with any kind of clarity at all, right? So making distinctions is important. And when we talk about pedagogical methods, you have to learn how to make distinctions between different kinds and learn what works where and when and why, how it works, and why different ways to communicate ideas and truths and different ways to be persuasive, right, which is what Aristotle says in the opening of book one of the rhetoric, is what persuasion is. It's the art. It's what rhetoric is. It's the art, the means, the knowledge of every available means of persuasion, right? And so you have to understand that this is not anything at all like pulpit preaching, right? Right? The church is not a place for Socratic dialogue from your pastor, your minister, your priest, ever, okay? Fire that guy or leave or go to another church. It's not a discussion, right? The church is not the Oprah show. How do you feel? Right? Like John said the other day, if you're in a Bible study, they say, well, how does that verse make you feel? Leave, okay? It doesn't matter how you feel. It matters what God means by it. And so when we talk about different ways to teach and communicate, there is preaching, which, biblically speaking, is authoritative, right? When a person who knows the word, who is trained, who is called into ministry, who is filled with the Holy Spirit, and who is living, you know, a life bent towards obedience, and they speak, there is a certain kind of authority in how that works. And different kinds of Christians, from, you know, Catholics to fundamentalists, will have different understanding of how that might actually work, right? But the idea is that the preaching of the word is an authoritative communication of divine truth that is immutable, unchangeable, and irrevocable, and applies to everyone in every situation at all times, right? That is not what we do in Socratic pedagogy. That does not mean that a classical school that does Socratic pedagogy doesn't believe in truth, doesn't mean that at all. It doesn't mean that we don't believe in goodness and truth and beauty. We don't believe in absolutes, or we don't believe in things that are final and settled. Okay, but Socratic pedagogy, because of the way human nature works after the fall, Socratic pedagogy, in the hands of an experienced interlocutor or teacher or discussion leader, can be an extraordinarily effective way to communicate those eternal truths to people, young and old, right? And that's what we're going to try to demonstrate today, or we'll have a dumpster fire and we'll barbecue some marshmallows, right? So there's preaching, which is authoritative, and then there's academic lecturing. How many of you ever had a boring professor in college? Yeah, pretty much. You know why I decided to become a professor? Because of bad professors. Now, I had wonderful ones. I was mentored by Stanley Fish at Duke University, and he was one of the most phenomenal teachers I've ever had, and I had a few other ones along the way. But sometimes as I was sitting there like, shoot me now. I'm paying money for this. I know you know stuff, but why aren't you excited about it? Why can't you communicate that kind of passion, right? And so there's authoritative preaching, and then there's academic lecturing, which can be wonderful or it can be terrible, but it is not authoritative, right? Every time some professor gets on TV to give their opinion, I just want to turn it off, and I don't even watch television, okay? Because normally they're a talking head who is saying something insanely foolish. Just because you have advanced degrees doesn't mean you're right. It probably means you're generally wrong about everything important, right? That's the way it usually works. But the Socratic dialectical pedagogical teaching method is an exciting and terrifying and enriching thing that, as I have said already twice, can turn into a dumpster fire. So I have no idea what's going to happen here. Now, this, on the one hand, is very scary for me to do, and I've done it a bunch of times. It can be very scary. But it can also be really exciting because it can get people all excited about Socratic pedagogy, and I never really thought about doing it like this or like that. But, you know, at the same time, you know, you can just have a disaster. And you have to learn, if you're going to teach Socratically, how to handle that as well. As a matter of fact, when I'm running Socratic seminars at university or college level or over at a local classical school for a demo or something like that, when it goes bad, I have had enough experience that I know how to turn that into a really good teaching experience. When you've got someone who dominates, right, or you have someone who won't speak or everyone who won't speak or everyone who tries to dominate, okay, none of that works. You have to learn how to do a certain kind of give and take. And when it works well, it's really a wonderful, kind of a beautiful thing. But it takes practice. And this is one of the things that I want to give students, undergraduate students who want to go into teaching in some kind of a classical form, university level, classical Christian school, whatever it may be, will give them a lot of experience in taking classes run like this, very different than most university lecture halls, and will train them for years in how to run these discussions themselves. And it can be an incredibly, incredibly effective thing. So sometimes I will use a single cultural object. I'll put a painting on there. I'll put, something like a Raphael painting, maybe the School of Athens, you know, the one that is required by law to be hanging in a bad print with no color correction in the classroom of every single classical Christian school in America, right? Okay. I walked into this one classical Christian school, I won't say where it was, and I walked into the lead humanities classroom. I'm like, they got a reverse Google image and put it through a bad color printer, and it was backward. Plato and Aristotle were on the wrong sides. And I ran a Socratic discussion on the School of Athens, the Scuola di Atene, which is in the Vatican in the Raphael room, and the discussion went on for 45 minutes before a student finally noticed, wait a minute, that's backwards. And that's the point, because that's kind of what all pagan philosophy is, isn't it? Right? That doesn't mean it's always wrong, it's just wrong and backwards. And therefore, you can learn from it. Right, and so what we're going to do is we're going to, instead of putting one cultural object up, a sculpture or a painting, a literary piece, we're going to actually do some kind of comp-lit, some comparative literature stuff. And I have two selections from two favorite works of mine, actually, that I think makes them interesting. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to try and put these two literary little selections into a conversation with each other, and we're gonna join into that conversation. That's what we're going to do. Now, the thing about teaching, if you were trained as a teacher, and I went through an undergraduate teacher education program, learned about two things. One, teacher education programs generally aren't that effective in making you a good teacher. Number two, you have to have a lesson plan with outcomes, right? You gotta aim for something. You can't just go in, I gotta fill 50 minutes here, right? There has to be some aim. And that is right, and that is wise, and that is good. You know, Jesus doesn't preach rambling, going, eventually I'll come to a point. No, he knows exactly where he's going, right? And all good teachers do. But with Socratic, where it looks almost entirely open, it's free-flowing, it's kind of like the ocean sloshing around out there, and maybe you can't see any particular currents or movements in the tide or the wave or something like that. A good Socratic example will have a leader who wants to go in a more or less general, if not particular, direction, but that is not something that has to be, or maybe even should be, revealed to the conversants at any point. Maybe not even until the end of the day, or the end of the week, or the end of the semester, right? You know where you want to get them, but you need them to get there. That journey is very, very, very important. It's very, very important, right? And you have to be... You have to be incredibly optimistic to run one of these things, right? Pessimist, it doesn't work, right? Because you're going to hit so many roadblocks, it's going to collapse. One of my favorite quotes from my buddy Dr. Marcos from Houston Baptist is, you want to know the definition of optimism? Carrying your skillet, your iron skillet, into Mordor. Because you might need some bacon, right? Yeah. And so you're gonna see the approach that I try and inculcate into the people that I'm teaching. What we're gonna do here is optimistic. I'm always trying to keep things moving in a direction that is positive, right? Because I know who's in charge of the universe, and he has good plans for us, even down to the level of our conversations, right? Okay. And so what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna ask if I can get maybe half a dozen people to volunteer, and I'll volunteer you. I'm pretty good at doing that as well. But is anybody, I'm not going to tell you what it is that I'm about to read to you and ask you to talk about. You'll have a little physical copy when you come up here. But you have to be, well, no, you don't have to be comfortable talking in front of people. It doesn't matter. As a matter of fact, if you're uncomfortable or if you're an introvert, you want to die if you're in front of more than one person at a time, I'm probably going to pick you to come up here anyways, right? Because you have to know how to get the extroverts and the introverts and the dynamic and the quiet people and the thoughtful people and the arrogant people and the proud people. To all kind of work together to have a conversation. It's about learning how to be an adult, right? Which would probably be a good thing for this country as far as political and religious discourse, right? Okay, so is there anybody that would like to volunteer? Just put your hand up and be like, yeah, I'd like to sit up here and talk for 40 minutes. And we're going to also do some meta-analysis. I'm going to hit pause a few times, and I'm going to ask people in the audience and people up here, what's happening, right? Anybody want to volunteer? Okay, are you from Tennessee? That's the volunteer state, right? What's your name?
Paul.
Paul? Can I call you George? I'm just messing with your head. Why don't you come up here and sit right here on the corner seat here? It's Paul, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, all right. Now, I like that sir stuff. The worshipful majesty thing works too. Okay, so anybody else want to volunteer to come? Would you like to come up? Yes, what's your name?
John.
John, okay. I won't call you Paul or George. I'll call you John. Is that all right? You come up here and maybe sit over here on the other end, anchoring the two sides. And then I'd like to get a couple of ladies. You know, we got a younger person and a wiser, older, mature person. All right, maybe we can get a young person. Maybe we can get a lady. Anybody else want to volunteer? In the red? Back there, what is your name? Okay, I have absolutely no hearing and no short-term memory. I have no hearing and no short-term memory at all. No short-term memory at all. Okay, so come up here, and when you get up to the chairs, tell me your name again.
Courtney.
Okay, so I've got Paul and John and Courtney. Starting to sound like the Beatles up here a little bit. Okay, Sean? Either way? Don't tell me that, because then I'll do it. Okay, all right. Anybody else want to volunteer to come up? Anybody else? Okay, come on up. What's your name? Lydia, okay. Do you go to Grove City? You're lucky. That's a great school. Fabulous. All right, wonderful. Not as good as my school, of course, but we won't talk about that. No, I'm just kidding, right? Okay, we're all doing the same thing. Okay, ma'am, come on up. Would you like to come up? No. Yes, yes, of course you can. Slow down? I was born in Virginia. This is slow for me. I'm going to slow down. Yes, I'm trying to move it quickly so that we can get going, and then we'll slow right down. I'll just read one line of poetry. You're not going to volunteer between you. Yeah, I used to preach at this church in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, when I taught at University of Alabama, and they come up afterwards and go, that was real good. Hey, I love Alabama. Last night I found myself sitting next to an Auburn dude, man. It got ugly, right? Okay, yeah, roll the tide, right? My pastor used to play for Paul Bear Bryant, and every sermon had a Paul Bear Bryant sermon illustration, and they were all great. Yeah, that's right. Okay. Anyways, they'd come up after sermon and go, could you just slow that down? Because you Northern Yankees from Virginia talk too fast. I'm sorry, I'm from Roanoke. I can't help that. Okay, I am going to slow it down a little bit, but not too much. Okay, anybody else want to volunteer, or can I volunteer somebody? Anybody else want to? Okay, you were just volunteered by your nice friend next door to you. Come on up here and have a seat. What's your name?
Pam.
Pam had to stop and think about it for a second? Okay, that's good. That's right.
I can call you George.
No, you don't look like a George. Okay, so you're Pam, and then this is John and Sean and Courtney, and then Lydia. Is that right? I'll remember you because Lydia reminds me of purple, and purple's a beautiful color. Okay, all right. Anybody else want to volunteer? Anybody else want to volunteer? Okay. Let's see. I see a lady in a white sweater, a shirt, pointing to someone to their side. You're pointing to each other. Maybe I should just select another person. Let's see. I got one, too. Okay. Let me take the gentleman to your right. Is that what I'm looking at? Okay. Can you come on up here? And I'm gonna ask you just one or two very brief things about yourself, just so I can find out a little bit of who you are and what kind of background you bring to this. If you're clinically insane, don't say that publicly because that'll mess up the whole thing. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you all each a copy of this. I have a few passages here, okay? And one is a passage from Paradise Lost. I'm a Milton scholar, so you knew there was going to be some Milton in there. He's a wonderful Puritan poet. Just finished a book on him that kind of gobbled up my life for the last 15 years. And after that, I have a passage, a selection of paragraphs from a novel, early 19th century novel. It was the first novel. It was written by Mary Shelley. A lot of you have probably read Frankenstein. Okay, I think it's an absolutely brilliant novel. When I tell students, oh, you know, they're like, oh, I want to be a writer, but, you know, I'm too young and dumb. I said, one of the greatest novels of all time was written by a teenage woman. And it's brilliant beyond belief. You can read it every year of your life, and you'll never be done reading it. It's so philosophically brilliant and artistically beautiful. It'll blow your mind. But how did an 18, 19-year-old girl do that? Classical education. That's how she did it, right? And interestingly enough, she has a lot of kind of citations of classical literary texts, including Milton, in her novel. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start off, and you guys have your sheets up here, and I didn't print 900 sheets because you guys are just going to listen. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read to you these passages without any kind of comment or explanation, and then we're just going to open up, we're going to have some discussion. And in order to kind of keep it civil here, instead of giving everybody a microphone, because I know you're all depraved sinners because I'm a Calvinist, there's one microphone. You have to say, may I have a microphone, please? And then we'll pass it, so it's not like a ninth grade Socratic, like when you teach fifth graders how to play soccer, and it's just this swarm of bees moving from one end of the field to the other, and the ball is nowhere to be found, right? This is from Paradise Lost, Book 4. This is Eve speaking to Adam, her husband, the perfect husband, the only one there ever was, sorry, other than Jesus, right? And she is talking to Adam because she recalls the moment that she, well, how do we say it, just kind of woke up into consciousness. She did not exist. God makes her out of Adam, and then, boing, there she is, right? I mean, that's how I feel most of the time. I walk around, where am I? What's going on? I don't know, right? Here's what she says. To whom thus Eve replied, and she's speaking to Adam, her husband, right? O thou for whom and from whom I was formed, flesh of thy flesh, and without whom am to no end, my guide and head, what thou hast said is just and right. Because Adam has just said, God is good, we ought to worship him, right? For we to him indeed all praises owe and daily thanks, I chiefly who enjoy so far the happier lot, enjoying thee, preeminent by so much odds, while thou, like consort to thyself, canst nowhere find. That day I oft remember, when from sleep I first awaked, and found myself reposed under a shade of flowers, much wondering where and what I was, whence thither brought, and how. Not distance far from thence, a murmuring sound of waters issued from a cave and spread into a liquid plain, then stood unmoved, pure as the expanse of heaven. Milton's a very visual poet. You're actually better off that I don't put it on the screen or hand it to you. Just listen to it and just make the picture in your head, right? She sees this beautiful little pond of still water. I thither went with unexperienced thought and laid me down on the green bank to look into the clear, smooth lake that to me seemed another sky. As I bent down to look just opposite, a shape within the watery gleam appeared, bending to look on me. I started back. It started back, but pleased, I soon returned. Pleased, it returned as soon with answering looks of sympathy and love. There I had fixed mine eyes till now and pined with vain desire, had not a voice thus warned me, what thou seest, Eve, fair creature, is thyself. With thee it came and goes, but follow me, and I will bring thee where no shadow stays thy coming, and thy soft embraces, he whose image thou art, him thou shalt enjoy, inseparably thine. To him shalt bear multitudes like thyself, and thence be called mother of human race. What could I do, Eve says now, but follow straight, invisibly thus led? So that's Eve remembering her boinging into consciousness, right? Like right out of a Christopher Nolan movie or something, right? This is from Mary Shelley's The 1818, the first text of Frankenstein. This is a little passage from chapter 11, then I have a little bit more from chapter 15. This is a little bit harder to follow, okay? This is when Victor, the guy who, you know, gets an A-plus on his science project by stitching together corpse pieces and making man, right, runs into this creature that he has built because he ran away from the creature when he saw how ugly he was, and then, you know, the creature goes out and, you know, wreaks mayhem all over, you know, Bavaria, and then, you know, Victor tracks him down and he finally catches him, like, what are you doing wreaking havoc all over Bavaria? This is terrible, right? And so the creature says, now let me tell you what happened when I popped into consciousness. So there's your immediate parallel, right? It is with considerable difficulty that I remember the original era of my being. You're like, that's Frankenstein? Although Frankenstein had a flat head, two bowls, went, argh, threw little girls into rivers and stuff. That's the universal 1930 Frankenstein. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is ugly, but he's brilliant and eloquent, almost beyond belief. Because he got a classical education too, although he went to self-homeschool, which you'll find out in a moment, right? It is with considerable difficulty that I remember the original era of my being. All the events of that period appear confused and indistinct. A strange multiplicity of sensations seized me, and I saw, felt, heard, and smelt at the same time. And it was indeed a long time before I learned to distinguish between the operations of my various senses. By degrees, I remember, a stronger light pressed upon my nerves so that I was obliged to shut my eyes. The light became more and more oppressive to me, and the heat wearying me as I walked, I sought a place where I could receive shade. This was the forest near Ingolstadt, and here I lay by the side of a brook, resting from my fatigue until I felt tormented by hunger and thirst. This roused me from my nearly dormant state, and I ate some berries which I found hanging on the trees or lying on the ground. I slaked my thirst at the brook, and then, lying down, was overcome by sleep. Soon a gentle light stole over the heavens and gave me a sensation of pleasure. I started up and beheld a radiant form rising from among the trees. The moon I gazed on with a kind of wonder. It moved slowly, but it enlightened my path, and I again went out in search of berries. I was still cold when under one of the trees I found a huge cloak with which I covered myself and sat down upon the ground. No distinct ideas occupied my mind. All was confused. I felt light and hunger and thirst and darkness. Innumerable sounds rang in my ears, and on all sides various scents saluted me. The only object that I could distinguish was the bright moon, and I fixed my eyes on that with pleasure. This is a little bit further on, where the creature, who's not called the monster or Frankenstein, right, finds a little library, three books. He's got a little personal library. One night during my accustomed visit to the neighboring wood where I collected my own food and brought some firing for my protectors, I found on the ground a leather portmanteau, a little bag, containing several articles of dress and some books. I eagerly seized the prize and returned with it to my hovel. Fortunately, the books were written in the language, the elements of which I had acquired at the cottage. They consisted of Paradise Lost, Man Has Good Taste, a volume of Plutarch's Lives, that's pretty good too, and The Sorrows of Young Werther, this crazy, romantic, suicidal, emo guy written by Goethe. Maybe not perfect taste, but decent, okay? The possession of these treasures gave me extreme delight. I now continually studied and exercised my mind upon these histories whilst my friends were employed in their ordinary occupations, because he's kind of living, you know, secretly outside of this little, there's like a little hut with some old poor people living in it. He says, I can hardly describe to you the effect of these books. They produced in me an infinity of new images and feelings that sometimes raised me to ecstasy, but more frequently sunk me into the lowest dejection. In The Sorrows of Werther, which is the story about this, you know, crazy young emo man who kills himself at the end because of, well, you know, he's a depressed German. Beside the interest of its simple and affecting story, so many opinions are canvassed and so many lights thrown upon what had hitherto been to me obscure subjects that I found in it a never-ending source of speculation and astonishment. I inclined towards the opinions of the hero whose extinction I wept without precisely understanding it. The path of my departure was free, is what the guy says when he commits suicide, and there was none to lament my annihilation. My person was hideous and my stature gigantic. What did this mean? Who was I? What was I? Whence did I come? What was my destination? These questions continually recurred, but I was unable to solve them. That's the first book he reads. The volume of Plutarch's Lives, which I possess, contained the histories of the first founders of the ancient republics. This book had a far different effect upon me from The Sorrows of Werther. I learned from Werther's imagination despondency and gloom, but Plutarch taught me high thoughts. He elevated me above the wretched sphere of my own reflections to admire and love the heroes of past ages. Many things I read surpassed my understanding and experience. I had studied human nature, but this book developed new and mightier scenes of action. I read of men concerned in public affairs governing or massacring their species. I felt the greatest ardor for virtue rise within me, an abhorrence for vice, as far as I understood the signification of those terms, relative as they were as I applied them to pleasure and pain alone. But, here's how you know how the monster has good taste, but Paradise Lost excited different and far deeper emotions. I read it, as I had read the other volumes which had fallen into my hands, as a true history. It moved every feeling of wonder and awe that the picture of an omnipotent God warring with his creatures was capable of exciting. I often referred the several situations, as their similarity struck me, to my own. Like Adam, I was apparently united by no link to any other being in existence, but his state was far different from mine in every other respect. He had come forth in the hands of God, a perfect creature, happy and prosperous, guarded by the especial care of his creator. He was allowed to converse with and acquire knowledge from beings of a superior nature, but I was wretched, helpless, and alone. Many times I considered Satan as the fitter emblem of my condition. For often, like him, when I viewed the bliss of my protectors, the bitter gall of envy rose within me. Another circumstance strengthened and confirmed these feelings. Soon after my arrival in the hovel, I discovered some papers in the pocket of the dress which I had taken from your laboratory. So these are Victor's notes about how to make a monster. And he found that, and he read it. In other words, he read the history of his own monstrous creation by his creator, who is ironically named Victor. At first, I had neglected them, but now that I was able to decipher the characters in which they were written, I began to study them with diligence. It was your journal, he tells his creator, Victor, of the 4 months that preceded my creation. You minutely described in these papers every step you took in your progress of your work. This history was mingled with accounts of domestic occurrences. You doubtless recollect those papers. Here they are. Everything is related in them which bears reference to my accursed origin. The whole detail of that series of disgusting circumstances which produced it is set in view. The minutest description of my odious and loathsome person is given in language which painted your own horrors and rendered mine indelible. I sickened as I read. Hateful day when I received life, I exclaimed in agony. Accursed creator, why did you form a monster so hideous that even you turned from me in disgust? God, in pity, made man beautiful and alluring after his own image. But my form is a filthy type of yours, more horrid even from the very resemblance. Satan had his companion, fellow devils, to admire and encourage him. But I am solitary and abhorred. What happens when you read this? Lydia, right? You're a student?
Yes.
What are you studying?
English.
Oh, perfect major, yay. Probably not. I tend to forget those kinds of things. There you go. You're a student studying English,
yes.
Right? Okay, have you read any Paradise Lost or Frankenstein before? Okay, yeah, it's because you went to Grove City. That's a great school. So, what happens when you read either one of these passages or both of them? What happens? Which, I just want to hear you talk. Yeah. So which one produces a stronger aesthetic response in you? Whether it's for beauty or for ugliness, which one goes, ooh? So the male monster is more emotional than the perfect female. Okay. He's definitely emotive, yeah. And then what's your name? You're Sean. Can you hand the microphone to Sean? What do you do? Are you a student? Are you a teacher? What do you do? You're a teacher. What do you teach?
I teach things like...
Hold your microphone up there. You teach Frankenstein and Paradise Lost. Okay, well, I got two winners here, right? Okay, yeah, and you got jobs. People actually pay you to teach poetry and literature. It's an amazing scam. Yeah, okay, so what happens when you read either one or both of those passages? Describe the experience of reading these passages. That's right. She's tempted by her own beauty. Okay, I'm just trying to make you feel awkward, that's all.
Yeah, that she is pleased and returns, and it is pleased and returns, and she looks of sympathy and love. So she's loving the look of herself. And
what does she think of this other being that she thinks is a being? Because does she get it?
Not, she has to be told.
She doesn't understand that this is her reflection. Because she went thither with unexperienced thought. What does she know? Nothing. No, like a high school senior, right? Okay.
And that's the difference between the two of them. And someone comes to invisibly lead her.
Who? Who else is in the Garden of Eden at this point? God. Yeah. It's not Adam. God is going to take her to Adam and say, look at this guy. This is Mr. Handsome Studliness here. You're going to love this guy. Yeah. He's even got character, which is a rare thing in men, right? Okay. Yeah, okay. All right, that's good. That's a good start. And then you were... You're Pam. Okay. When you read this very powerful imagery of Eve seeing her image, what happens? And then what do? Do you teach? Are you an administrator? Are you a student?
I'm a math teacher.
You're a math... Oh, good. I got a non-literary person. Okay. You seem to have turned out just fine, so it's okay, right? Okay, so what happens when you heard that read, and when you read along with it, with Eve seeing her reflection and falling in love with it? What happened? What happened to you? What did you think?
Response from that part.
Mm-hmm. You want to see where it was going, and then I broke off the little selection, and all of a sudden you're in another book, like, wait a minute. You know, that's how I felt in math class, you know? Well, a quadratic formula, I don't have that yet, and all of a sudden we're doing calculus. No, stop, slow down, right? Okay, all right. So he says... that she seems to be tempted. Is that right? She's tempted by her own beauty. How can you be tempted by your own beauty?
I wouldn't know I'm as beautiful as
Eve. Yeah, no, me neither. None of us are, not anymore. Okay? So can a person be tempted by their own beauty, and how would that work?
It's some sort of action.
Mm-hmm.
Good
action, bad action, indifferent action? How often are you tempted to do good? Never. Yeah. No. Oh, no, I've got to resist that. No. Right. We're tempted to do evil after the fall. So, is she being tempted to do something evil?
Well, does it actually say tempted in here? Or is that...
He's the English teacher.
No, I added that word. I'd say maybe.
And what evil particularly?
Well, so if you think of things that we ought not to do to the thing...
So the problem is... multifold, tempted to love her own image and remain there enamored of herself. Okay? So, does it appear that it is wrong for her to look at what is functionally a mirror? Is it wrong for her to look at her reflection? Does God say, thou shalt not look into ponds, mirrors, you know, take selfies, none of this, you can't do that. Does he say that? No. Okay, so is it wrong to be aware of your image? Is her reaction to her image accurate, Pam? What does she think of her appearance? Somebody find the line or two. Mm-hmm. Yeah, do you want to read that for me, Sean?
Sure. It's going to back.
Now, do we know at this point what that image looks like, how that image appears to her? No. She just, there's someone there. Okay? It's kind of like the classic episode of I Love Lucy with Harpo Marx, right? In the mirror, right? Okay. Okay, so she sees an image. Does she know that it is an image of her, of herself? Does she even know that it's an image as opposed to a reality? Okay, all right. So, Courtney, do you think that she's tempted to do something evil or wrong? And if so, what exactly is it? And what do you do?
Okay, I'm a student.
Okay, great, all right. Okay, excellent. Tempted by her own beauty. Okay. Oh, now we're getting somewhere. Say the word again a little bit louder.
Vanity.
Yeah, okay. What is vanity? What is vanity? You have no personal experience. I'm just asking you hypothetically.
If I were vain.
Mm-hmm. And is your image the same thing that you are? So if there's no reflective surface around you, do you have no image? When people see you, do they only see an image of you?
Yes, and please start talking.
Okay. Okay. Now, let's step out. Let's hit pause. Rewind just a little bit. Okay. What's happening? Don't talk about the poem and the piece of prose. What's happening? What am I doing? We're trying to define some terms. Yeah, very good. What's happening? I'm working my way around to bring everybody into the conversation the first few minutes.
You also are stewarding profits. My list was.
That's right.
Input from the students to progress.
Yeah. I had no preparation other than to print these out and to have been alive for 54 and a half years. No prep, because I don't know what's going to happen. You guys are doing really great. I'm doing wonderful as well. But you guys are doing great with this, okay? You're jumping right in. Okay, what else? Anybody in the audience, just put your hand up and speak up a little bit. What's happening? And can everybody hear? I hope I'm not too fast. Yeah, ma'am, what's happening? Which is not a bad thing to do in a Christian education context. As a matter of fact, that better be the main thing that you're doing, especially if you teach Ovid, whew, right? Okay. Somebody, yes, sir. I'm requiring them to listen to each other. I even listen to you, and I don't even know you. Okay? Yes, sir. Yeah, Steve. Do I have an agenda? I always have an agenda. But am I forcing and pushing a particular thread at this point? And I'm asking some questions, but at this point, I'm just trying to open up enough things to where, and my goal to run a Socratic is at the end of the class, whether it's a three-hour graduate seminar or a couple of, you know, ninth grade screaming squirrels over at Trinity Classical Academy, when the bell rings or I say time's up, they're like, no, okay? I have walked across the courtyard at Trinity during lunch and watching students have arguments about Augustine when they're 14, and I'm like, I win. Right? Because that's what you want to do. You want them to be sad when it's over. So let's see. I've heard a little bit from you. How about let's unpause it. Now, why don't you tell me about the referentiality back and forth between these two. In other words, tell me something about how these texts might be talking to each other. And you're Paul, and what do you do? You had to look at your thing to see what you do?
Well, it says I'm from Alabama, but I'm from Georgia.
Okay. They're both fabulous states.
Yes. Good. Most recently, I came from a first grade classroom. God stepped me into a sixth grade classroom, eighth grade classroom, and then 11th grade classroom.
Okay. All right. So you said first grade.
Yes.
And you know never to ever tell anyone, oh, I'm just a first grade teacher or just a lower school. By the way, I hate that term. We should get rid of that. It's grammar school. Oh, I'm just a kindergarten teacher. I want to slap you when you say that. You are the first soul former in your school and you're just that? Okay, so you're the one forming the cookies before they go in the oven, right? So, first grade, but now you're moving up to, I don't like upper school either, but you're moving into logic rhetoric school, older students, right? Okay, so tell me how these texts seem to be talking to each other, or maybe they're talking to some other texts as well. Maybe you hear some echoes of other things.
A creation responds to creation. So.
To its own creation.
To its own creation.
And does it remember its own moment of creation? Reel it back. Do you remember when you were born? That's such a good thing in God's design. Could you imagine how horrifying that would be? Some woman you've never met is screaming, get it out! Ah! You know, some doctor you've never met, whack! You know, then they're sticking things in you and getting ink on your feet. It would be terrible, right? So you don't remember the moment. You certainly don't remember the moment of conception. That would be particularly awkward, right? So you do not remember the moment. So what is your earliest memory? That's a great memory. Wait, wasn't that a movie I saw once?
But
do you remember the movie and you put yourself into hero identification process? Okay.
I thought I saw it in the corner and it wasn't wrapped, and I knew that was mine.
You knew that was yours. And that stuck with you, and that began to form your identity. Your identity began with desire, with covetousness, with sin and selfishness and violence. Yeah, your parents had you properly gendered. Okay, we got it right. Okay, that's good. Let me get it back. Sean, what's your earliest memory? What's your earliest memory? Do you have one?
Car after church.
Oh, that's sweet. That's really
I don't know
sweet.
Why, but I'm probably about three.
You want to have an interesting evening. Sit around and just try and reel back and dig back into your earliest memories. Because you will eventually come to a place where you know that you existed, but you either formed no memories or they are no longer accessible. In other words, who were you like? The Frankenstein creature?
And Eve.
A monster and a perfect human being, female. Right? Whereas Milton says about Eve, God's last best gift. Right? Because God always saves the best for last. Right? Okay. So, what is this saying about Courtney? What is this saying about memory? What are these texts, either one or both of them, saying about memory? And go ahead and get yourself ready because you're going to be next. It's important. What is it? What? Yeah, hold that right up here. What is memory? What is it? It's important, but you don't know what it is?
Images.
Is it always images? And how does that work? How do we record the past in images and sonically and orally and through the olfactory sense, right? I smell lavender, I immediately picture my wonderful Southern Belle grandmother. Grant, would you like me to make you some Rice Krispie balls? Because I walked past a lavender bush. She's been gone for decades. But the smell triggers me. What's your earliest memory? Memory's the weirdest thing, isn't it? Now, let's say you're in some kind of horrible sci-fi movie with Keanu Reeves and they've erased your memory. Are you still you? Are you still Courtney from Grove City? All memory is wiped. Are you still you? Do you know who you are? Have you had your experiences? Do you know whether you love or hate liverwurst? Are you you? Is a soul a thing without content? They pay me to annoy people, by the way. She thinks she has an answer. Watch this. She's walking into the quicksand and doesn't even know. She's like a naive Boy Scout. Okay, keep going. No, go ahead. Is the soul a container into which content is poured? Is a brain, you know, a vessel into which knowledge is poured? I don't think anybody that's into classical education thinks that the brain is a container that you simply pour out and then, you know, you spigot it out and then they give you a paycheck every 2 weeks.
So can't other things and people remember for you?
Here, let me give it to Pam, okay, because I haven't heard from her for a minute. And she's looking really, really worried right now, but I know she's got a great thing to say, right? Because as all the classical ancient scholars knew, the quadrivium comes after the trivium. And the greatest clarity of thought comes from those who have mastered number, number in time, number in space, and number in space and time. The quadrivium, arithmetic and geometry, right, and music and astronomy, right? They're trying to solve the problem of motion. So you know this. So the clarity of thought. Here we go. No pressure. Whatever has your interest at this point. You can take it in an entirely another direction if you want to, but you can't talk about like geometry and stuff. Talk about these.
I really want to talk about stuff.
Yeah?
Well, I guess what you're asking is, do our experiences and our memories, do they make up who we are?
Identity. Perfect. Math. Mathematician. Right to the heart. Who and what is Eve? It's the philosophical ontological question. What are you? This is the Hamlet's question, right? This is the question that goes all the way back to Plato. It's really the question that goes back to the pre-Socratics, if you know your ancient philosophy, right? This is the question that everybody, this is the question that the advanced robots and even Harrison Ford's character asks in Blade Runner, right? These are the questions. Who are you? You know who else asked that question? Who are you? The Who. Great rock and roll song. Brilliantly self-reflective lyrics, right? Who are you? For like 20 minutes, something. It was really cool. Okay? All right. So, what do we mean when we say identity? What do we mean by that? Your identity. He's a lot better looking, for one thing.
That's true.
Oh, so we have a second order of creation. Yeah, for those of you who read the great postmodernist philosopher Jean Baudrillard, this is the second order simulacra. It's a copy of a copy, right? Because God made Eve, and eventually you end up with Victor Frankenstein, really smart biology student in the university, right? And then Victor makes something. When God made man, he made man in his image. When man tries to make a man, keep going.
Well, I was also thinking about all the different talks that we've been hearing, and a lot of them have been geared toward identity. And a lot of them are talking about like how this Generation Z is, in a way, like really sad and hopeless because they've lost their identity. And just thinking here about Eve, who immediately is met with this guy who...
And who is her guide? Who is Eve's guide who says, no, no, Eve, don't fall in love with yourself? Who is her guide?
God.
It's God who made her. And then he tells her, I'm going to bring you to someone in whose image you're made. So is he saying, you're made in my image, I'm taking you to me? Who did he make Eve for? And Adam for Eve, we could say. Right? So God makes Adam in his image and then makes Eve in both his own image and Adam's image. Right, but she's the last best gift, okay? But what about Victor? You want to tell me about Victor? That was great, man. What about Victor? Who? What's his? You've read this book before. Have you taught this book? You had the privilege of teaching. It's a fabulous book. Yeah. What grades have you taught it?
Ninth grade.
Ooh, so you're just wrecking their brains. They walk out just flipped out. Teenage girl, man, what? Okay. So the creature is made by Victor. Who's an undergraduate? Okay. So, yeah, basically, you know. Science major, so we know he's probably smart. So, what is the creature's problem? Is there some ontological, like he's just necessarily nasty? Okay, he's stitched together from corpses of criminals and all that kind of stuff. But, what's his real problem?
He's made an image of an imperfect thing.
Imperfect? Fallen, evil, wicked, depraved, imperfect, sometimes stupid.
He's vain. He's in love with the greatness of what he's doing right up until the moment that he succeeds, and then he sees it as something else.
He has created his creature to demonstrate his great glory as a BS in chemistry or whatever it is, right? Okay? So he is Victor is actually kind of mirroring or imitating his creator, God, who created man in his image for his glory. So when God makes man in his image for his glory, what else does God do for his glory? What does he do for his glory? Name, start naming things God does for his glory. It's a short list. Everything. Yeah. So, Victor's vain. Is God vain? Good answer. You're in Texas, son. Yeah. Right? No. So, can you do things that are glorious for your glory? It's just a general question. Can you do glorious things for your glory? Yeah, Liddy, go ahead. Okay, so specify it that way. Can you do glorious things for your glory? Not are you capable of, but let's moralize it. Should you do it? Should you do glorious things for your glory? Okay, more good. That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's right. And his favorite book, and again, he has great taste, is Paradise Lost. And when he reads Paradise Lost, how does he say he takes it? What is the end result of his hermeneutic grid? He says he takes it as Plutarch's Lives and Sorrows of Young Werther as what? A true history. In other words, he doesn't understand that Sorrows of Young Werther is a fiction, that Plutarch's Lives is somewhat propagandistic, kind of like Virgil's Aeneid. You know, you read Virgil's Aeneid, you know anything about Roman history, and the whole time you're reading those beautiful Latin hexameters, you just hear the sucking sound of Virgil sucking up to Caesar Augustus. Please, you know, patronize me, right? Okay. Paradise Lost, fact or fiction? Yeah. So how dangerous is it to write a gigantic, imaginative, poetic, beautiful, artistic epic about truth from the Bible? Ooh, that's dangerous. Yeah, right? Okay. You're Paul. So, what is the major classical reference going on that links these two texts? When people say that, I answer in Latin. There is a particular topos, a particular commonplace, a locus communis, a well-known passage from classical Roman literature. It also goes back to Greek mythology. And there is a quite direct reference in the Eve story, and there's a tangential one in the Frankenstein story, although a passage of Frankenstein that I left out. He has a similar experience where he looks into a pool of water and he sees himself and he's like, oh, I'm ugly. Narcissus, yeah, from Ovid's Metamorphoses, right? Yeah. So do you know the Narcissus story enough to give me a two-sentence version of it? It's simple. Why? Really gorgeous man, yes. Yes. You're not suggesting that George is narcissistic, are you? Because last time I went up into the Starbucks next to my house and he was sitting there, we were chatting, I asked him if he was a narcissistic, and he's like, I'm not even capable of narcissism. Look at my 5 o'clock shadow. Right? Okay, so keep going. This is good.
So he falls in love with an image of himself, and then he is cursed by
an insert. He falls in love with his own image, falls in there. You know, he's a man. He's a little slow on the uptake. It's a mirror. And he falls into the water and drowns, and he's metamorphosed into the Narcissus flower. And his punishment comes as a result of the fact that he rejected a nymph, right, whose name was Echo. And Echo had, you know, this slight problem because she'd upset Juno. So her curse is all she can do is finish the end of someone else's sentence. She can never start a conversation. She can just finish, so you get the cute Latin there. Equis ades, ades, oh, are you here? I am here. And so it's really cute in Latin, doesn't really work in translation. So it's like a guy's dream date, a girl that can only repeat what he just said, right? Okay. So what you're having in, now think this through, what you're having in Paradise Lost is an echo of the Narcissus myth, because it's all a reflection, isn't it? The Narcissus myth, which starts with the echo Narcissus myth, she ends up as the echo out in the woods because she pines away and becomes what bounces off of cliffs. She becomes nothing but a sound. He becomes nothing but an image and drowns. What happens to Eve? In this passage, or if you know Paradise Lost, which if you're a Christian, you should know. Are you saved? Are you a believer? You haven't read Milton? Come on. Right. Okay.
She's led away.
She's led away by who? And there is a modifier that describes how she's led. Invisibly thus led, what could I do but follow, right? See, that's Milton's whole, that's his lesson. You will be invisibly led by a voice, not Echo's voice, because he's real. And he will lead you where? Away from one thing and to another. Away from self-love and to the love of what God has made to bless you with. How about the creature? Can we get back over here to Sean? About the creature. What's the creature's problem? Either or both. He reads it.
Yeah,
reading is dangerous.
And so I think that Paradise Lost as true history and identifying with the villain.
With the devil who's filled with envy against all the beauty that he doesn't get.
Right.
Okay. So we're out of time, but let me ask you, Courtney, what just happened here? We just looked at some poetry and some prose, and then what happened? Just very briefly. What happened? What was this like? Right. and take it to other places outside the text. Pam, how about you? What just happened here? This is outside of your discipline, so what was this like?
It was very uncomfortable.
Good.
And especially like not having read these. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just like repeating back what this said as like, oh, this is what it said. Good job, you remember, move on. Like,
right.
We actually had to think like deeper and past just like the face value of it. Yeah. So yes, it was very uncomfortable.
And ultimately to think theologically about who and what you are and what you're worth. That is the only, I mean, I love literature, I love art, it's beautiful, I live in Italy in the summer, I take students around, it's fabulous. The only ultimate value of any of that or any of this is when you're pointing your students to a real understanding, a clear and a true understanding of who and what they are and who and what God is. You understand if you're a classical Christian educator, you have one lesson plan. Point your students to Christ. Everything else is, it's not even secondary, it's tertiary. That's it. All right, well, we could do this for hours. We can hang out in the, you know, the pub or the coffee shop over here later if you want to chat more about this, but I know you're feeling very uncomfortable. Thank you all for coming, and I hope to see you tomorrow morning.